Hello and welcome to ID Talk, answers from an infectious disease expert. I'm Dr. Sean Elliott, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with Tucson Medical Center, professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and long-term contributor to the infectious diseases and immunizations topics at the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This podcast has been created to answer questions from our chapter's members about the COVID-19 pandemic and pretty much everything else infectious disease and infection prevention related. This is the week of March 18th, 2024, and welcome to all of you chiming in or tuning in from Arizona and outside of Arizona. Again, some great questions coming up. And before we do that, just to sort of survey what's happening out there, certainly this season's respiratory viruses, including influenzas A and B, RSV, rhino/enterovirus, adenovirus, have certainly peaked, plateaued, and are declining in many parts of the country. They're trending in that direction here in Arizona as well, although there are certainly plenty of patients experiencing respiratory viruses coming in with varying degrees of croup and bronchiolitis and respiratory failure. But overall, the numbers have been slowly trending down, and it would appear, knock on wood, the end is in sight. Scattered throughout all those is still our dear friend SARS coronavirus 2 with the most recent sub-variants of Omicron and still causing, again, a very typical upper respiratory tract process resembling COVID croup, if you will, but more importantly, co-infecting patients with other respiratory viruses, which then, of course, increases the severity of their oxygen hunger and their need for admission. So pretty much the same as reported 2 weeks ago, just hopefully slowly decreasing and going in the right direction. So since it is now slowly seeing a decrease in the number of flu cases, the first question is quite pertinent. And the questioner asks, can I review the new trivalent flu vaccine, which we are expecting to see for the next season, 2024/2025? So this is indeed a change. I think we've all become somewhat used to the quadrivalent or four serotype flu vaccines, which have been provided and required since, for quite some time. This is the first year we're going back to a trivalent, and so the expectation is that the next season's, next year's flu vaccine will include a breed of H1N1, a breed of H3N2, and influenza B/Victoria. Going away for the next flu season is influenza B Yamagata serotype, since that specific serotype of influenza B has not been seen, reported, or found in the world since March of 2020. So it's been 4 years now without seeing that isolate around, and therefore it is felt to be not necessary to include that. In August of 2024, we will receive here in the States the newest recommendations and vaccines available so that we can begin our typical flu vaccine series in the fall, September, and certainly October. So just as an interesting corollary to that, and many people ask, like, how are these things decided? What's the process to come up with the constitution of the flu vaccine, certainly here in the States and elsewhere in the world? And this is, it's a neat process because there is a lot of thought which goes into it. So most importantly, there are several factors which are considered by the CDC, the American College of Immunization Practices, ACIP, and also the World Health Organization, all of which contribute to this decision. And what these groups do is look at several factors. First of all, they look at which flu viruses are making people sick in the preceding season. Well, makes sense. And therefore, what might be anticipated to be causing that in the upcoming flu season. And with that, we can harness the flu season epidemiology from the Southern Hemisphere, so those who are already experiencing flu virus infection, because we can anticipate that that is likely to affect what we will be seeing in our flu season. The next thing that's considered is the extent to which those viruses are spreading or expected to spread prior to the upcoming flu season. Certainly looking at how well the preceding flu vaccines covered what was out there, in case, you know, there was a major oops or lapse, and a typical expected coverage would be anywhere from 40% to 50% efficacy or protective efficacy of the vaccine. That actually is good, believe it or not. And then finally, the ability of the virus vaccine serotypes to provide cross-protection against the range of related expected flu viruses, either of the same type or at least of the same subtype or lineage. And this is important, you know, for example, if we are off a little bit on an influenza A H1N1 in the vaccine, does it still provide cross-protection to another H1N1 which might be out there? So those are the factors that are looked at. And then to get the data, there are currently 144 influenza centers over the world, over actually 114 countries, pretty cool, that conduct year-round surveillance for flu virus serotypes. And they do that as part of the World Health Organization Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System. Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful, but it's one of the working and reliable networking groups that actually gets input from countries all over the world. So these influenza centers sample thousands of flu virus strains every year and report their data to five World Health Organization collaborating centers. And those five are the CDC, big surprise, here in the States, the Francis Crick Institute in London, the Victoria Infectious Disease Reference Laboratory in Melbourne, Australia, the National Institute for Infectious Diseases in Tokyo, Japan, and the National Institute for Viral Disease Control and Prevention in Beijing, China. So those five then collaborate at meetings twice per year to identify those features I just mentioned. What's out there? What's coming? What's the coverage? What's the cross coverage? And out of that then comes the actual recommendation for the vaccine makeup, which we then get released to us in the fall hour for flu season. So that is sort of where we stand right now. So coming up for this next year, not right now, we're still, although we're pretty much done with flu vaccines by now, but coming up for the 2024 flu vaccine season will be a trivalent of flu vaccine, all the types, whether it's live attenuated, whether it's the injected inactivated, the egg-free, all these will have the same makeup of a influenza A H1N1, an influenza A H3N2, and influenza B Victoria. Okay, moving on to something different. Have any additional measles cases been identified in Arizona? So, in case one has somehow failed to see all the media and all the reports and not listen to the last podcast or two, yes, we're in the middle of a national outbreak of measles cases to date, and this is as of just, well, the 14th, so just 4 days ago. The United States is up to 60 confirmed cases of measles across the country, being reported from 17 states. The top two states out of that outbreak are Illinois, currently with 12, and Florida, currently with 10. But Arizona, unfortunately, is definitely on the map, where we have, well, had three confirmed cases coming to us from Maricopa County. And now, as of the last several days, two additional ones coming to us from Coconino County, so sort of the Flagstaff area. One of those is confirmed, one of those is suspected, although it's anticipated that the suspected case will end up being confirmed. So that is where we're at. Yes, so two new cases are one for real and one likely coming to us from northern Arizona. From my part of the state here in Pima County, so far no cases, but it doesn't take a whole awful lot for an infected, contagious person to travel on down I-10 to get anybody here in the southern part of the state. So for those of us in Arizona, definitely keeping the eyes open for suspect measles cases, having a very, high index of suspicion and a low threshold to test for suspected measles cases. Testing, if you have a suspect case, your number one step should be to call your local county health department, A, to identify this reportable condition, and B, to coordinate with them to send the testing to the state lab for confirmation. Testing will typically be a throat swab and potentially a urine specimen for PCR testing, and also sending serology to look for acute onset of disease and even potentially an immunoglobulin A positivity. So keep the eyes open. And again, and I've said this the last several podcasts, but the classic measles case is going to be fevers, followed then by the three C's: cough, coryza, conjunctivitis. The cough is a thick, they call it a brassy cough. We might liken it to that person with adult person with COPD or a smoker's cough, but it's very productive sounding, loose, wet, and very productive sounding. The coryza is initially clear nasal discharge and then getting on the mucopurulent side. And then the conjunctivitis looks very much like your worst adenovirus nightmare. So serous drainage from the eyes, full conjunctival injection. And then, after those have been developing, the patient may then develop the classic measles rash, morbilliform, meaning flat erythematous macules, which sort of different shapes, starting typically up in the head and neck, and then moving downwards. Classically, they say that the rash resolves on like the head and neck as it goes to the trunk, but realistically, you're more likely to see patients with the rash everywhere, just maybe slightly starting to fade up more toward the cranial region. So please keep the eyes open, have a very low threshold to at least contact your health department and or your friendly infectious disease provider and discuss next steps if you have a suspect case. Okay, next up, I read that the CDC may make changes to the adolescent meningococcal vaccine schedule. Have there been any official recommendations about this change? Well, so as of right now, and I think we may all have seen the 2024 vaccine schedule released by the CDC and endorsed by the AAP, the official vote on this has not yet come from the ACIP, but this is very much what they will be voting to approve, and it is quite rare for ever to be changes made. The changes that you will note, however, have to do with the fact that Menactra, which had been one of the quadrivalent meningococcal vaccine products, is no longer available as of October of last year, October of 2023. But in its place, there are two other quadrivalent meningococcal vaccines, that being Menveo and Menquadvi. And again, I'm just using the names just to identify them. I in no way wish to endorse or non-endorse any vaccine products. This is just for informational purposes only. In addition, however, to having the quadrivalent vaccines, as we all know, there's now available a meningococcal type B vaccine, or vaccines, Bexsero and Trumenba. Trumenba. There we go. Say that three times fast. And those are very important to add in a shared decision making to certainly the adolescent who's maybe college bound or high risk patients, in addition to the quadrivalent. So the point being that there's A, C, Y, and W135 as serotypes of Neisseria meningitidis covered in the quadrivalent vaccine. Then there's the serogroup B, which is also equally important, in fact, is a significant contributor to meningococcal disease here in the United States. So it's important if we're going to vaccinate against meningococcus to do so completely. The newest product, which is the pentavalent, called Penbrea, is an alternative, and that can be used as per the vaccine schedule, certainly for a booster dose, should you have had a younger adolescent who was immunized at around age 11 or 12 as per protocol, and or can be used as a single dose for that college-bound student, and then boosters can be provided 6 to 12 months down the road. So yes, there are changes. It mostly has to do with them including this newest pentavalent Penbrea vaccine, but also formalizing the recommendations for how to vaccinate both young at-risk children and certainly adolescents beginning at age 11 or 12 years of age, and again at 16, against all five important serogroups of Neisseria meningitidis. If you haven't already, you can certainly download the current vaccine schedule for 2024. It's available through cdc.gov. It is referenced, of course, through the American Academy of Pediatrics and should be very easy to find and download there. And then the last question goes back to COVID-19 vaccines, and very important question. In terms of advocacy in young children for the COVID-19 vaccine, do I have any recommended talking points to bring to the parents? I sometimes will let them know that the COVID vaccine has been shown to prevent long COVID in pediatric patients. Yeah, that is, I think, a very important vaccine support talking point. Certainly, we can still hold out the fact that SARS coronavirus 2 is present. Yes, it is settling into a sort of seasonal epidemic model, but just like with influenza, both A and B, COVID-19 still has great potential to cause morbidity and, in some cases, mortality. So there are children who are being infected and severely infected with SARS coronavirus 2, certainly if they have underlying chronic lung disease, including those patients with asthma, which may or may not be well controlled with their controller plan. So as a important vaccine to prevent a bad outcome, that is certainly a very important talking point. And I imagine many of us have experiences with our patients who were hospitalized with COVID-19 and who did quite poorly. Also, as noted by the questioner, vaccines have certainly been shown to reduce the risk of and the severity of those living with post-acute COVID syndrome, aka long COVID-19 syndrome. And certainly, if you have personal stories to share about adolescents, especially in your practice, who have developed long COVID, I certainly have a couple I can share with you, and these are significant. So previously, very active student athletes who were like top of their world, doing great, very active in after-school sports, very active in school and extracurricular activities, who developed what is the equivalent of severe chronic fatigue syndrome. So unable to get off the couch, unable to get out of the house, unable to focus on school, failing out of school and or being pulled out of school and then doing online learning, and even that has been an unmitigated disaster. So long COVID in kids, while not as frequently associated with COVID-19 as in adults, is certainly still a 10% risk in children and adolescents who get COVID-19. So being vaccinated against COVID-19 absolutely reduces that risk, and also both the severity and the length of time that our young patients may have COVID-19. And then as a final or an additional feature, our dear friend MISCI, or Multisystem Inflammatory Syndrome in Children, MISC, is not gone yet. We certainly have not seen many cases after the change in SARS coronavirus 2 to Omicron subvariant, but it is not gone. And so those patients who do develop MISC after the COVID-19 have very significantly challenging outcomes: cardiac failure, cognition issues, coagulopathies. And these are previously healthy children, especially who are unvaccinated, who then now will have lifelong illness due to that failure to vaccinate. So I think those three: severity of COVID-19, severity and risk of long COVID, and risk of and severity of MISC, are all three important to share with patients who may be on the fence about being vaccinated, or families, I should say, about vaccinating their children. The younger ages do less well. Of course, that makes sense. Their immune systems are less mature, and so it is even more important to vaccinate them and to get that pre-existing immunologic protection prior to aging into adolescence. Certainly, those adolescents who are not vaccinated should strongly consider doing so, again, for the risk of long COVID, especially. So, those are sort of the talking points of the advocacy. If your families are science believers, gosh, I hope they are, then we can share that the AAP and the ACIP and the CDC and the FDA and all the organizations strongly, strongly, strongly advocate COVID vaccines for everybody, especially including young children and adolescents. And others who may or may not necessarily be moved by science conversations may be moved by the personal stories. So, as with many other cases of people who are vaccine hesitant, it's the sharing of the personal stories which sometimes move those who may otherwise be unswayed. We've actually done prior echo projects and videos available through the AAP and also through the chapter talking about, other factors and features which can be used to sway that vaccine hesitant family to support vaccines in general, and specifically vaccines against COVID-19. So there you go. Great questions once again, and thank you as always for listening to ID Talk. Arizona AAP members can submit questions for future episodes to covid@azaap.org. The Arizona AAP would like to acknowledge the generous support of this podcast by the Arizona Department of Health Services through the Title V Maternal and Child Health Services Block Grant funding. For more information and resources related to COVID-19 in Arizona, or to learn how to become a member, please visit us at azaap.org. And in the meantime, and as always, keep hanging in there. Thank all of you for your service. Be on the lookout for those measles cases and everything else out there, and keep fighting the good fight. Thanks, everybody.